No Directions PaizoCon 2019 seminar coverage is brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/NoDirection.
This is the Industry Insider panel, and apparently, I'm told, I am the Industry Insider. And we will be discussing how ideas become RPG products. Or, since there are like five of you, any other topic you want to ask about. Do you want to?
I could.
Get in here.
All right, well, I just got to set up the mic in another room, okay. And then I'll be right back.
My name is Owen Casey Stevens. I'm the Starfinder design lead at Paizo. I am also a consulting alumnus at Green Ronin. I am also the publisher at Rogue Genius Games. I am also a producer for Wright Publishing. I have also worked for D20 Weekly, White Wolf, freelance in all of these cases, Sword and Sorcery, Kobold. I worked on staff for Wizards of the Coast from 2000 to 2001. And Ryan's back. Yeah, see, I said that was Richard. They were saying, that's the bad guy. It's not the bad guy, it's Richard.
I mean, he's not a good guy.
But that doesn't make him a bad guy. Just because you're a bad guy doesn't mean you're a bad guy.
So what bugs me about that is that Zangief is not the bad guy of Street Fighter. He's just a bad guy. Like he's got that completely backwards.
Well, I mean, there's Zangief and then there's Zangief. So there's the role and then the right.
Okay.
You know that not all video game characters are their own personality,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've seen Wreck-It Ralph.
Okay,
so
good.
I do know this.
Have you seen Wreck-It Ralph 2?
I have.
All right.
It's all right.
All right.
Yeah.
Off my panel. No. And this is Ryan Costello.
Hello.
Who similarly has a long list of credits. Let's hear some.
So, as far as the industry goes, I am a designer and developer of games for Blind Ferret Entertainment. So, not just games, actually. I designed this action figure, designed these games that tie into our products. And for a while there, I was trying to launch an original concept division that it got shut down, but I can still give you feedback and ideas about what went wrong and what went right and give you directions in case that's the direction you want to go. And then the other side is that I am an influencer. I host the No Direction Network. I'm the host of the main show. I kind of coordinate all of our blogs. And No Direction is like one of the biggest gaming blogs and podcast networks that's out there. And it's completely dedicated to Pathfinder. So for a single topic or like Starfinder also, and then we're starting to broaden out, but like for something with such a narrow focus to get the reach that we got, we're doing something right.
Are you going to cover the adventure card game?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we are. Yeah, we're actually getting review copies sent to us, which is fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So I take it I won't be selling you a card game for the division that got shut down?
No.
Okay. Oh, no, sorry. On the spot. Okay. So this panel is about how ideas become actual game products. It is relatively easy to sit around and think to yourself, what we need is a, and I'll pick a random example, a Starfinder Critical Hit deck, right? Okay, we need a Starfinder Critical Hit deck. That's an idea. Between that and a product that people can put money down and get, there are many, many, many steps. And those steps are at least similar, regardless of what the product is. The process of, for instance, writing a 500-page RPG is different from the process of creating a board game or the process of having a figure, but there's still a lot of things that happen similarly along the way.
Yeah, there's design, there's development, there's approval processes, there's budgeting, there's getting someone to approve that budget, preferably not you, but, you know, sometimes you got to hit into your own bank account to start funding things, depending on how independently you want to produce things.
There are questions like form factor. The same information can frequently be presented to people in different ways. When I am working through Rogue Genius Games, we mostly put our games out as PDFs because we don't want to take the risk of having inventory. That means that there are places we're not selling our products, so the total reward possibility is reduced. But from our point of view, the risk possibility is reduced more. When I put out a PDF, I can't lose money on it. It's done. Whatever it costs to make that thing and put it out, that's it. If you print a product, the moment that you're paying the printer and no one has paid you yet, you have taken a bigger risk. The idea, of course, is that it'll be sold in more places and you'll make more money, and that's a way to have a bigger, more influential, potentially, product. But since I already work for a number of companies, for my own smaller company, it's just not a risk I want to undertake while juggling everything else. You were talking about having a division and having it not work out. So there are obviously some lessons to be learned there. You want to speak on some of them?
Sure. I guess the large one was the Kickstarter. The idea was we were going to launch a game division. The first game was going to be Ruthless 86, which got to Kickstarter. And within a couple of days, had not caught fire. And so the decision was made to pull the plug on the Kickstarter so that it wasn't just this
long, painful process because, as weird as this may sound, you get like 90% of your funding from a Kickstarter in the first couple of days and the last couple of days, and you'll get all of your media attention in the first couple of days. So if you are just a Kickstarter that has landed flat, there's almost no point in just hoping that it goes along, because any contact to a media source of being like, hey, like, do you want to cover this so that you can help us? They don't care. They want to know what's in it for them. And what's in it for them is usually the exciting story that they can tell so that they can get people paying attention to them. And then by that, they then go to your Kickstarter, so, or whatever crowdfunding platform you use. And there was a lot of decisions we made that we thought were the right ones. Like, we decided not to have a rulebook posted on the Kickstarter because that would take laying out the rulebook and that would take time away from our art team. But if we explain the rules briefly, people will like the game enough. That ended up being the exact opposite. People, the immediate comments we were getting was like, well, I don't know if this is a fully developed game. I have no ability to have faith in this game to deliver because you've given me nothing that shows this is something that's at a certain point of development that I can have faith in it.
And the flip side of that is if they put up a rule book and had no art, people would have said, well, I don't know what this is going to look like. It's not interesting. I'm not excited. Crowdfunding is a particularly tricky business. One of the most important things that Ryan just laid out there was, and I put this a little differently, if it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. There is no amount of adding new stretch goals or putting in new updates or reaching out to new sources that is going to cause a dead crowdfunding campaign to pick up. There are lots of things you can do if you're successful to expand your success. There are a lot of things you can do if you're going to be marginal. Different people have different opinions about this one. I personally am of the opinion that you should make sure you're going to turn a profit whatever your stated goal is. Some people prefer to state their goal where they can do it but won't turn a profit so that they will fund faster, because the perception is the faster I fund, the more we can say we're hitting stretch goals, the more excited people get, the better the media attention is. But that does mean if you say this is going to take $10,000 to do and all my time will make no money whatsoever and we make $10,004, you have dedicated a lot of your life, possibly weeks and months, for $4. And yes, you can try and sell that into distribution, but there's, again, no guarantee that that will go well either.
Yeah, that specifically relates to my Kickstarter. We had a $70,000 ask, which is what it would cost us to make this game and then turn a small profit on it. Some of the feedback I got when I was consulting some of the people, my industry connections after the fact, was like, oh no, you should have asked for like $14,000. It's like, then we would have been at a significant loss, even when this thing is successful. Like, we would have been on the hook for quite a lot of money, which feels like the opposite of what crowdfunding is for. There's a lot of psychology to crowdfunding. You have to convince people that this is, or you have to figure out what people believe a goal for that should be, regardless of the reality of it. Same thing for shipping is something that a lot of people will just lie about what the shipping rate is because people don't like the reality of what shipping rates are. And then those lies continue to set expectations. So when we were realistically saying this is what it would cost to ship it at the end, people were like, no, you're gouging us. It's like, no, everyone else is absorbing some of that loss.
Yeah. And crowdfunding is obviously not the only part of an idea turning into an actual product. But one of the most important questions is, what's your scope? What's it going to take to get it done? Just to get into the industry at all, the barriers are in many ways lower than they've ever been. If you want to do a card game, you can literally write it yourself. You can do a usable layout by yourself. I would recommend getting an actual graphic designer. But again, for your first... And there's one waving in the back. But you could do that, and you could do it print-on-demand cards through drive-through, and your out-of-pocket is the amount of time it took you to put that together. Now, that isn't going to become the next Uno by itself, but it is the sort of thing where you can put something out there. Sometimes what you have to do is build a base, build a reputation, prove you can do something. There's a Kickstarter going on, Kickstarter right now called Grimmerspace. Yep. One of the things they did was they put out a free adventure. So they said, look, here's an entire adventure for Starfinder. The whole thing's done. We're going to give it to absolutely everybody free in PDF, so that reduces the cost, but they still have to do the art and the layout and the editing. So that when we ask you for money for this bigger, more expensive thing, we have proven to you we can deliver this level of quality. Here's the tone. Here's some of the people involved. The other thing they did with that was that since they put it out through drive-through, they could then update it with a link to the Kickstarter. So everyone takes this free thing, and those people are now picking up advertising for the Kickstarter because they will get a reminder, this has been updated. The update is, hey, here's a link to the Kickstarter. Clever marketing and pre-work can get a lot of what needs to be done done. Frequently, a well-marketed bad idea will sell better than a badly marketed good idea.
And Grimmer Space, not saying it's a bad idea, it's actually a good idea. But for pre-marketing, they announced this last year.
Yeah.
They announced originally Wesley Snipes and Sean Astin were involved, and that was just a press release they sent out everywhere. And even though people had vague ideas about what the final product would be, I'm not even sure if Grimmer Space's name was attached to it yet.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, well, what people did know is that we had these two, this strange bedfellow Hollywood types that were joining in with established industry people, and this was something to look forward to in the future. So then when it was re-announced, people were like, I remember that from last year. I had those feelings then. This develop has happened now, and so you can have that much more faith in the product. And it showed an arc. It showed that there was progress made on this, but that was all progress. Whatever was made was at someone's expense. It was at
someone is paying expense for those things. Yeah. They're doing videos that takes time, if nothing else. And again, you can do a video with a webcam and your bedroom. I've done that.
Maybe your game room. So you better backdrop.
That depends. I mean, I was literally in my bedroom when I did the Rebel Lieutenant recording, and that's my best one at more than 250,000 hits.
Wow.
So the ones that I've spent more time producing have had significantly less attention on them because it caught.
Yeah.
It's something that showed up on the front page of Reddit, and I have no control over that. It's just one of those things that happened. But getting yourself established, getting your name out there, that helps make all the rest of this happen. I kind of want to go through what I see step by step, and I'd like you to leap in as we go.
Sure.
Frequently before there's an idea, there's a need. That depends on how established you are. But for example, at Paizo, we know there will be a 2020 schedule that will have for each line a set number of products on it. We need to decide what those products are. So we haven't even had an idea for a product yet. And we're looking at a piece of paper that says you're going to have to put something here, 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 and here. Because Paizo is very established, that frequently says, and we can spend X amount of money, and we need it to make Y amount of money because we're setting a budget for the year.
Yeah, and that's similar to what happened here. Like, Orphans and Ashes, the first game that I produced for Blind Ferret, we just needed a looking for group-based game for Gen Con 2015. 2017, we wanted an expansion for it. 2018, we wanted another LFG thing that was not related at all to Orphans and Ashes, so that's where Storytime with Dick came from. And so it was just like, that was my directive. We need a product, a game. And so it starts developing multiple different directions we can go. And then you pitch it before too much time and money has been invested. Just, here's an abstract idea of what could eventually look like this. There's a stretch here. Do you want me to start filling in the gap in the stretch?
Sometimes between that, we know we have to have a thing. And here is a thing we could put there. How do we like it? You have to spend some time thinking about what do we want this product to accomplish. We do not expect anybody to take the Starfinder Critical Failure deck and use it for any other game, right? We know that the market for this is a subset of Starfinder players. On the other hand, we also sell Starfinder-branded battle mats. You can use those for any game where a science fiction-like setting with one-inch grids is useful. There are people that use those for Shadowrun. They use it as 40K terrain sometimes. They use it for modern games. There's a bunch of things you can do with that. So those have different potential markets. We don't put a lot of time into the story behind our battle mats. We have a description and like a paragraph of what you could use it for. But those are for everyone who thinks it's cool to pick it up and use it. We do a lot of those. We don't package 20 of them together. Because our expectation is some of them you'll want, some of them you won't. That is a sort of point of purchase kind of pickup thing. With the Starfinder Critical Fumble deck, there is actually more story there, but the story is your very bad day. Part of the point is to make people laugh when they're using that product. One of my design remits was a lot of these should be funny, right? We've got titles of those critical fumbles, things like, you know, kinetically induced stupidity. You've been hit in the head. But been hit in the head isn't as funny as kinetically induced stupidity. And I knew that those were going well because I kept hearing the editors laughing when they got to it, which was a good sign. If we wanted to have a product that we want to bring people into our brand, that's when you get something like the Starfinder Beginner Box. So there the idea is we want to be able to put this in front of someone and make them interested in our entire brand. we don't just want them to play the box, because we're not going to do a second box and a third box. There aren't going to be expansions to that box. That box's purpose is to teach you how to roleplay, get excited about our intellectual property, and get you to pick up the rest of our products. So as an acquisition product, it has a different set of needs.
Now, when I would... I haven't brought this up, but I used to run a board game subscription box called Board Game Mento, and one of the things that went into the box was a promotional item, and I had two separate budgets. One was the promotional budget, one was the game content budget. For something like the beginner box, is that... Like, is the profit margin allowed to be a little less because the potential to then sell the books and the brand itself goes up?
So, at Paizo, we have different departments that handle different things. And so how these things come together is not always clear at all stages. So I know that box sets are expensive, that box sets have a good shelf presence. If someone walks into a store and they see even a 126-page book, hardback with this thin little spine can just get lost. The Starfinder beginner box, there's no place a retailer can put it on the shelf where it does not draw some attention. That's one of the reasons why it's not the Starfinder beginner book. We wanted that attention, but then it does drive up the cost. So there are a number of concepts, and I literally can't speak to where we went on the beginner box. My guess is that we decided to squeeze the margin down, but we still had a margin. There are products called loss leaders, where you say, okay, we're not going to make money on this. We are going to lose money on this product, but that is going to get people involved, and therefore we will make more money later. So the free adventure Grimmerspace did is a loss leader. They made $0 on that adventure. They obviously spent more than $0 getting it written, getting art for it, getting it laid out. I mean, I was around when some of it was laid out. That happened in my house. That is a loss leader for them. They're trying to get people excited, and they're trying to get people to agree to be on a mailing list, and they're trying to get people to be available. So that is a marketing cost for them. Another possible, a famous example of loss leaders, right, is, hey, here's a razor. It's incredibly cheap. We won't make any money on it, but you need razor blades to use it. And the razor blades, we can mark up because they're individually less and make the profit on the razor blades. Now, that's... I am old and bearded, so razor blades might perhaps not be the best example anymore.
Well, speaking of old, can I give my favorite example of a loss leader?
Of course you can.
Comes from G.I. Joe.
Okay.
If you know action figures, they put out a toy called the USS Flag. It was an 8-foot-long toy that's basically the size of a coffee table, and it's an aircraft carrier. One, it was made... there was no profit on the flag, but what happened was parents would see that. The kids would say, like, can you buy me that? And parents would say, like, how about I buy you two G.I. Joes instead of one because I can't buy you the thing you actually want. And so the sales of everything but the USS flag were double the year the USS flag came out. And the USS flag was basically just a big action figure-shaped poster for everything else G.I. Joe.
And sometimes there are things like customer engagement, right? The existence of something like the USS flag excites G.I. Joe fans, because look at all the awesome stuff that exists for this, my hobby. I've got a Wizards of the Coast Colossal Red Dragon. It's a foot off the ground. I bought that retail. Most of my figures this big I got for being in the industry, but I paid for that sucker, which I have used, I think, 3 times over nearly 20 years. But while it looks good on a shelf, I was excited by the presence of it. You'll see the same thing sometimes when there are box promotional items for miniature sets. Hey, these are randomized, but if you buy a box of 100 of them, we will give you this figure of a wizard on a black dragon you can't get anywhere else, or Orcus, or all the stuff you need for a tavern. Those are size huge elemental. Those things are designed to excite you, and even the people that don't buy it are sometimes motivated to get more involved in the industry and more excited.
Yeah, with that red dragon, I didn't buy it, and now when I see it for like $200-$300, I've got like fear of missing out for the next big exclusive.
Uh-huh.
And I'm more likely to buy the next big dragon that I put out.
And for a while, I had the Colossal Red Dragon, the Star Wars Miniatures game AT-AT, and the Wizards of the Coast Cthulhu. When I moved, I only kept the dragon.
Oh.
Because I'd only ever used the other two once each.
Right.
And that's because one day I decided my 16th level characters are going to have to deal with an AT-AT Cthulhu and a colossal red dragon because I'm using these figures once
again. Yeah, that AT-AT was my Tarrasque.
I'm sorry, what?
Also because we moved from our 2,000 square foot house to a 500 square foot.
Yeah, that's the other reason I got rid of it. So you can have a loss leader where you actually lose money. You can have something where you squeeze down the profit margin or even to zero where you're not making any money. And then you can have products where you're specifically saying, we're going to spend this much, we're going to print them. print a budget is crucially important. Without a budget, the best idea in the world is likely to die somewhere between actually working on it and actually getting out. I have talked to so many people who run, for example, Kickstarters, where they get $120,000, and they didn't budget carefully, and they discover that what they're doing costs $150,000 to get out and ship to people, and so they raised six-figure money, and they lose money. After you know what your market is, what you want your product to do, how much money you're going to have for it, what your distribution channel is, then you start to have drafts and revisions.
Yeah, you do. So, at least with board games and whatnot, the stuff that I've been involved in is usually the drafts are your playtests. You get out a game and it's just like the numbers seem to work, but then you have to figure out, like, are those numbers fun? Do those numbers actually work when people interact with them? Are the words you've used clear enough? And so you do multiple levels of playtesting. You do everything to get it in people's hands. And then there's various ways you can playtest. One of them is you are a player at the table, and you are just observing how the other person is interacting with the pieces. You are there to explain all the rules. And then every other version of playtesting kind of takes you out one step. One of them, you'd be like, you'd be GMing or just kind of observing other people play it. And then there's a third one where you are behind, you know, a double-sided mirror, and they don't know that the designer of the game is watching them, and then you will get the most honest feedback you'll get for that game. If you're just playing with friends, they'll always tell you that it's great. But when people think that they are playing a game and there is no consequence to the truth, you will get the truth.
That also, people can be very, very smart. Even if you're not saying anything, if you're in the room and one of them says, I guess we're supposed to open this first, and you look happy, they have gotten feedback that they're supposed to open that first. If you're behind, being behind two-sided glass is tricky, but if you can be totally deadpan, right? I mean, literally, there have been a few products that the Pathfinder Beginner Box had that kind of blind testing. It was that level of important. Since we already knew that Starfinder Beginner Box was based on some of the things it did, we instead for that, we brought people into a room with a great big table, and we sat way at the other end of the room and said nothing and had our clipboards and tried to be deadpan. Little things like what order products are in a box can make a difference. So for that playtest, we thought we had absolutely everything in place, and the first time we ran it, they couldn't make characters. The really frustrating part about that is they didn't need to make characters. We had pre-generated characters. But when they took it apart, they ran into the rules for making characters before they found the pre-gens. So instead of being playing within 15 minutes, they took a two-hour session and never got to the point where they could roll a die. That revision process, there can be a lot of levels to it. At Paizo, we have an outline stage where someone who is kind of in charge of the project says, here's the things we want to accomplish. We have a writing stage where people in-house and or freelancers write to that outline. 5,000 words on halfling battle muffins, 5,000 words on magical kitchens, 5,000 words on alchemical indigestants. Right?
And wait, when is this book coming out?
Halfling battle muffins is my universal ridiculous example. I've been using it for 15 years. Because that way everyone knows I'm not talking about any actual product. LJ says 2022. The Hobbit Sauron of Rogue Genius. So then we have 15,000 words. Then we got to develop it. Our developing standard at Paizo is that if we have different people writing something, it is very important for one person to go through that entire product and make sure that it is consistent in tone, in presentation, in expectation. One of the things that can happen is if someone has an outline and they're like, oh, we're going to have rules for magic ovens. So here in this section I'm writing about the halfling war muffins, I'll have a whole bunch of rules about how the magic ovens make them work differently. But I'm presenting those before anyone knows anything about magic ovens, and that person doesn't know what the magic ovens are going to be yet, so he just says, any magic ovens can do this. And if I as the developer, just put the book out that way, and someone's reading through, they're like, what magic ovens? What? Why are there 12 magic ovens? So all you have to do necessarily is put it in a sentence. There are 14 different kinds of magic halfling ovens. They're found on page 42. When using those, you have the following additional options. But the person who was writing that section didn't know they were on page 42. He didn't know how many different magic ovens there were going to be. That's the sort of thing that it's not necessarily that the freelancers aren't doing good work. It's that when they are not in-house, not together, not doing it together, we want someone to unify all that. We also, somewhat egotistically, believe that we at Paizo know our world and our audience and what's exciting. better than other people, and sometimes it's just easier to take a work and make it more awesome than to hit that level of awesome by yourself sitting in front of a computer.
Now, since you've talked about now talking with other people, it's important to point out you cannot be precious about things you've written, especially in the early phases, but you also shouldn't feel bad about defending things that you do really feel like maybe your developer hasn't quite got the importance of it, or maybe you've playtested something and then the developer sent it back to an earlier draft, which was the logical thing that playtest prove is not the best way to go. There's basically, there's a lot of diplomacy, and the best thing you can do is just try and take your feelings out of it and just look at it as like, what is for the best for the product?
So as a hard example of this, last year at Gen Con, I demoed a card game that I wanted to sell to Ryan. And one of Ryan's responses was, I like a lot of things about this card game, but the way you have it set up, you need a pad of paper to keep track of scores. And he, as the prospective publisher, doesn't want anything that doesn't fit in a single card box to be necessary for this game. So I've created a game. We can play it. We had fun playing it. But there's this question of, do I want to say, no, I'm not going to sell this to you if you can't say you've got to have a piece of scratch paper? Or am I going to say, I've already got a potential solution to that? Or am I going to say, I am convinced that we can find a solution to that problem. I understand your concern. When we move forward, we can bring some other people in. And that was a case where it just wasn't ready to move to the next stage. But that's an exact example of sometimes you have to kill your darlings. The thing that you love the most, that is most important to you, that is the crux of a project for you, no one else may care about. And the project may be more successful without it. But you also have to defend your vision. And that's a very tricky place to be. But it's important when you're putting together a product to give serious thought to what is the crux of this product. What is the most important thing? If I'm doing a book on halfling warbakers and someone is really, really, really excited that they've added dwarven fudge, I may say to myself, one dwarven recipe does not belong in this book. I've got a number of choices. I could turn it into halfling fudge. That doesn't seem quite as interesting, but at least it thematically fits. I can put it in a sidebar. Hey, here's an exception. This is frequently sold with dwarven battle muffins, right? I can say this just doesn't belong. No matter how cool it is, this does not belong in this product. This is not part of this thing. We're going to take it out. And those are the kind of decisions that you have to make as you're going through that process.
You want to open up some questions? See if we're going the right direction for these people?
Yeah. Let's go. And they're just the two of us. So if you have, like, any question, if you want to know about good Georgian doctors in Kent, ask us. I've got an answer. Yes, in the back.
So, one thing I'm curious about, I've been following you on Facebook for a while, you seem to have a lot of products that come out quite often.
Uh-huh.
How many, irons do you have in the fire?
All of them. Okay, so I've got a number of different companies I'm working with or own or work for. At Paizo, which is my day job, that is my supposed to be 40 and I frequently actually spend 50 or 60 hour a week job that pays my medical insurance, for example. There is writing, or boosting the product that is recently for sale. So the beginner box is out, someone does a good review of it, even though I'm on salary, so I'm not getting a cut of that. The better that sells, the better the company is doing, the better my line is doing. I want that to be popular. So when I see a good review of it, I will go on social media and say, hey, here's a review of the beginner box. That's something that's out of my hands, but I'm still at that level involved. I was running demos of it here because you have to support. This hits on a very crucial product. You frequently must support your product after it's out. So you have to allow time for that. Then there's the thing that currently I am writing promo text for, I'm writing blog posts for. Whether or not it's announced, that is a product that it's done, in quotes, or off at the printer, but I'm getting ready to tell people it's coming out. So it's the second thing that I've, second iron in that same job. When I get into work Tuesday, I have to start copy fitting a product. That is something that we have laid out, but we guess at how many words fit on a page. We know exactly how many pages this product is. If the number of words either are way short or too long, we don't want layout to guess which of these game rule words are critical. The developer does that, which is another reason why we've got a developer on top of having our freelance authors. So there's that product, which I'm going to have to do that with. I have another product that I'm currently developing. I have gotten manuscripts in. I'm trying to put it together. I have another product that I just finished the outline on, and I have to assign it to freelancers and get them worked with. I have another product that is about to be in the outline stage, so we are doing the pre-outline conceptualization. So that's like 7 or 8 things that I'm doing at once at Paizo. One job. I am a publisher for Wright Publishing. That means that I have a product coming out next week. I have to be writing promo text for that. I have to be looking at sales, because in that case I'm the producer. I don't have a separate marketing team. And deciding, do I need to boost something? Do we need to buy an ad for something? Do we need to put something on sale? Because I think it would be really popular if more people saw it, but no one's paying any attention to it. I've got a product that is currently in layout. I've got a product that is currently in editing. I've got a product that is currently in development. I've got 3 products that I am personally writing for that are in different stages, because those are little piecemeal products. That's the 55 line, if anyone's seen them, 55 ranged or minor weapon upgrades. I can't sit and write 55 interesting themed things all in a row. So I've got several of those open so I can think, oh, I can do 55 minor cybernetic upgrades. You can get neon striping and look cool. All right, I don't have to come up with 54 of those right now. I can hop to a different one when the idea comes to me. I've got projects that are out with other developers, say freelance developers, and I've got outlines. That's a second company. Rogue Genius, I'm the publisher. So I have entire lines of things that I've got other developers on top of. So I've got one person outlining it, a second person writing it, a third person developing it, a fourth person outlining it, a fifth person doing the editing, a sixth person doing the layout. If I want a product to come out every week, and it takes roughly a month for each of those things to happen, and it's 7 stages, the things I'm putting out right now started 7 months ago. And I have 28 projects in the pipeline. Or I won't be able to produce one every week. I am also currently an alumnus of Green Ronin. I used to be their Pathfinder line developer, but they did all the Pathfinder products they wanted. They are taking a pause. All I do for Green Ronin at the moment is they tell me what they're doing, and I tell them if they think that's a good idea, and they give me cheese. But that is important for me, because that is a bunch of brilliant, well-connected, experienced people. By maintaining that relationship, the reverse is true. I can say, hey, I just had this idea for a product about cannibal clowns from outer space. Is that brilliant or stupid? And of course they all said both. That is both brilliant and stupid. You can totally do that. And people will be, it is so out there that people will be excited and comment and laugh at it. Especially in social media, someone sharing it and saying, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Facebook doesn't care if it's the dumbest thing they've ever seen. They care that it's been shared and commented on. That means they show it to more people. That means that I've got more prospective audiences member. So I haven't actually broken down all the math, but I would guess at any given moment I have between 50 and 100 projects at different stages. That is ignoring things like the card game that I was doing on my own, or the fact that I've got a Patreon running that I produce per material for a blog for. I try to do it on a weekly basis, but I have told my Patreon people I don't promise that. You are paying me to try to have more time. The more you pay me, the more free time I have. I inherited a game that was started by Adamant, who then sold it to Super Genius, who then handed it to me as a consolation prize when I was bought out from that company, that is now 5 years late, was not crowdfunded, was pre-ordered, and I consider all, even though I never saw that money, all those people are my customers. And so I have told them all, I will do this game someday. If you get tired of waiting, I will give you a refund. Even though I never made the money, that is my responsibility to them. And in that entire, God, I guess it's 7 years late now? Yeah. In that entire 7 years, I've had 2 people say, I'd like a refund. I could have a bunch of people stand up and say they'd like a refund someday, and then my pool of money I can do with other things will go away. And it will be disastrous and unfortunate. Luckily, that hasn't happened. That's a project I've still got to get to, but I've got hundreds of things in front of it. I do too much. A couple years ago, people convinced me to take a 2-week vacation and not do any work, and I ended up in the ER. I'm a game design shark. If I am not moving forward, I will suffocate. If that process works for you, there are benefits. There are also people who put out one game every 3 years. It's a great game, and everyone's excited by it. Don't kill yourself over games. As it happens, I've got games as my literal 40-hour or more a week day job, games as my side gig, games as something I'm doing with some friends, games as a spare time Patreon. I have just taken pretty much every waking moment of my life and put it in one pool. That if you have something you love and you do it as your job, you'll do it forever and you never get a day off. Ryan, how many projects do you have in the fire at any given moment?
I mean, if we count canceled ones, a lot. But
well, so, are they canceled ones things you still want to move forward with somehow?
I'd really like to, yeah.
Okay.
I'd really like to get Ruthless 86 off the ground, and I still think about it.
Uh-huh.
I still think about how I can convince my boss to revisit it.
So if it's got brain space, then that's an iron in the fire.
Okay. But then generally, I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing because my day job, I go, you know, 9 to 5 working at Blind Ferret, so everything Blind Ferret related, I think about it at Blind Ferret, and I'm able to leave when I leave Blind Ferret. I will call my family a portion of my brain space because that
fair.
Basically takes up from like 6 o'clock till 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a couple of hours to work on personal projects, so little like... Small projects that I know have no end goal, they are taking up space, and if I don't work on them, then they will always be occupying some part of my brain and distracting me from other projects, so I might as well put some time into it. And then there's all the network stuff, which is, I've been running the network for over 10 years now, so most of it runs itself, and so that is something that takes up way more, or way less of my time than you might assume. I've got the 2-3 hours that we record every 2 weeks, and one blog post that I write every 2 weeks. Everything else, I'm just there to make sure the checks and balances, everything's working, and otherwise I leave. I trust my team, and they go off on that.
But that means that you've got one project that is the blog post, one project's the recording, and one project that is project management to make sure everything's going smoothly.
That's right.
So this one thing is 3 projects all the time.
Right. And yet, takes up less time than, like, what if I were to turn this weird little idea I have into... maybe a novel? I don't know. Do I want to be a novelist? How do I go about doing that? I'll just start a Google Doc and we'll see how often I dip back into it. So it's like the things that have no purpose often take up half of my design and development time. And then the stuff that I'm actually working on, most of the time, my boss has a lot of faith in me. And apparently, you know, the stuff that I put out works well for him. So the stuff that I do in my day job tends to just be the autopilot stuff. And the other projects, the ones that, like, hound me are the ones that it's, like, it's hounding me because I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a creative endeavor. You will, when your career is over, have a closet full of ideas you never managed to get where you wanted. No idea of mine is ever thrown away. I literally have an entire folder with subfolders, and the folder's marked bad ideas. These are ideas I had that I could not let alone, that I don't want to forget, that are for whatever reason bad ideas. Sometimes I find myself thinking, didn't I already have an idea about this? Wasn't there something I was going to do? And I'll look at my bad ideas and I'm like, that's a terrible idea. But there's a nugget of something good in there as a result of the change of the market. You know, Starfinder didn't exist at one point. There are things that were bad ideas for Pathfinder. It's a bad idea. That are perfect for Starfinder. Cannibal Clowns from Outer Space might be an example. We started at one point doing April 1st products, which are actual game products. You can buy them. They're real. You can take them to the table. But they include things that were in my bad idea. Look, it's Toonomancy. It's the ability to create a giant ink hammer as a spell. But for technomancers, it's pop culture magic. If there were magic users in the real world, Bugs Bunny would be one of their icons. All those silly things would be something that would inspire you to do spells. Once a bad idea, now I find a niche for it. Does that 20-minute rant answer your question?
Yeah, like 15 other questions.
Great. Do we have more questions?
Somebody else go first.
Yeah, please.
What would be cost involved in developing a project?
It depends entirely on the project. If what you want is a 16-page RPG product that you want to sell as a PDF, for example, you can write that entire thing yourself. There is free software you can use to lay it out yourself. You can use public domain art that you find online, but make sure it's really public domain to illustrate it with that art yourself. You can get a free publisher account on DriveThruRPG, and you can sell it. Total monetary cost out, zero. If you want a professional editor to look at it, and I recommend that, then you need to pay that editor. Some people do that through saying they're going to have a revenue share. Hey, if you edit this for me, I'll give you 25% of all the money I make on it, or I'll give you 50% of all the money I make on it in the first year. Some people like that. Some people don't. There are pros and cons. One of the pros is that if it turns out to be the next hot thing, instead of getting 4 cents a word, they get half of all the money you make. The con is that if you sell two copies and you make 25 cents, they get 12 and a half. If you want custom professional art, you pay for that. There's a middle ground. For example, you can, like, DriveThru has an entire publisher resources section. So you can, here are potential front cover layouts, and here are interior art elements, and here's stock art. So there's a range of things. As soon as you're talking about getting a professional to write it, a professional to edit it, a professional to lay it out, you're for an RPG product, which is where most of my expenses, or most of my experience comes from, you're talking about X number of cents per word. You figure out how many words per page you get, maybe 900. So if I want 10 pages, that's 9,000 words. If I'm paying a writer 5 cents a word, then 9,000 words, it'd be $45.
Sure.
No, $450. I was off by an entire... And have a contract. Yes. And have the contract have these things listed so that you don't think you owe them $45 and they think you owe them $450, because it's easy on an email conversation or a chat to misunderstand or misspeak. Contracts put everything in writing so that everyone has expectations. If you want to print things and get into regular distribution, then you've got a whole other set of expenses. You've got to find a printer. The more copies of something you print, the less each copy costs you. But you have to sell more in order to break even. So if I want to sell 500 copies of something that I'm going to sell for $30, well, the people that are selling it for $30 are the retailers. So they want to make money on it. They're only going to pay 60% of that $30. All right, so they're going to buy that for $18. They're going to buy that from a distributor. The distributor wants to make money. So he's going to insist on a 10% margin. So he's going to get another $1.80.
It's only 10%.
It will vary by contract and group, and okay. Like, you know, if you're doing a fulfillment house versus a full distributor.
Okay.
But it could easily be the case that for this $30 product, you will get paid $16. Of that $16, the government wants their share. So when you have your budget, you better say, well, we think we're going to be taxed at this tax rate. So that's gone. An excise tax might hit you that's above and beyond your printing costs, and you might not have a lot of warning, and I might be thinking about current events. So you want to have at least some sort of margin in there, like, you know, 10%, 15%, here's our disaster fund. So let's say, let's say that you've ended up spending $10 per unit is what it breaks out when you amateurize it for the writers, the editing, custom art, all that. So you're saying, okay, for this $30 product, I'm actually going to make $6 per unit. If I print 500 of them, they will charge me $5 a unit. So I'll make $1. So I do all this work and I'll make $500. If I print 1,000, they'll only charge me $4. So I'll make $2 per. But instead of spending $5 for 500, 2,500, I'm now spending $4 for 1,000, 4,000. So I still have to sell 500 to break even, or sorry, 1,000 to break even on the print cost. So the print cost per unit goes down and down and down as the number of units I print goes up and up and up. This is one of the reasons why reprints are sometimes not economically viable. If I have a 300-page book, and I printed 20,000 copies of it, I got the print down cost quite a bit. And if 4 years later I have sold all 20,000 copies and people say, well, you should reprint it. But should I? I might not be able to sell another 20,000. I can look at how many I've sold over the past 18 months. If I sold 15,000 the first 6 months and 4,000 the next 6 months and then a couple hundred a month until I ran out, then it would take me, if I print another 20,000, I might be saying, well, that's 15 years of inventory. Where am I going to put it? If I have a garage, I can put it in my garage. But if I'm putting it in a warehouse and I don't own that warehouse, they will charge me for putting it in that warehouse. So it may not be economically viable to reprint a product that's popular and sold out. Then you can start talking about things like, well, we've got a PDF version, so you guys can all buy the PDF, because there's no warehousing cost for a PDF, there's no print cost for the PDF. Once the PDF exists, it's there. I might say, you might notice that Wizards of the Coast now has some previous edition stuff available print on demand or PDF through DriveThru. the unit cost for that is way high, right? They might well at that point be saying, for this $30 book, we're going to give you 65%. That's basically what drive-through gets you. So you're going to make $19. And it's going to be 12 for the print costs. You're only making $7 per, but there isn't yet another middleman, and hopefully you've covered all your amateurized costs, so if five people buy it, you make $35 more than you would have if you didn't do it. There are people called print buyers whose literal job is to look at what you want printed, get quotes from various printers, and tell you what all the costs and risks and time is. The classic production triangle, cheap, good, fast, still exists. Generally speaking, you can get at most two of those. So if you want it to be cheap and good, it will not be fast. If you want it to be fast and good, it won't be cheap. If you want it to be fast and cheap, it won't be good. I recommend budgeting these things out and looking at everything through the whole process. And different things just have different costs.
Speaking of process, so whenever I'm approaching a new project, because there's such a variety to the things, like Owen will, like your scope will tend to be the same. It'll be books and books per pages, so it'll be a little more predictable than like it could be anything as an end result. I'll have the notepad stage, which is when I open notepad on my computer, and I'm just writing the idea down. I don't even need a spell checker to tell me if it's a like if my spelling is correct. I just need, this is the concept, and then I present it. Is the concept worth pursuing? This next stage is the Excel document stage, because that's when it becomes very facts and figures based. I have to break down this idea. What is the reality of this idea? What are the costs? What are the things that will actually contribute to the end cost, the end price, and the potential for sales? So once I've broken that down, I present the idea again, and it's like, is this worth now opening Word and starting to do the creative stuff? The first step for some people is the third step for me, because I need to make sure that whatever the thing I'm actually putting my time into is viable. And once it leaves Word, it goes to, you know, Photoshop and like layout and stuff. And that's actually out of my hands. But if you have artistic skills, you could potentially do every single step of the way. But each step of the way, it's like you have to think like what different computer program is using this and what is that computer made? What is that program made to handle? So concept, budgeting, creative, layout. That's generally how my arc goes. And then we go to production, which things get back in my hands because I've got the contacts in China and, you know,
you are your own print buyer.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're looking at costs, you can also say, where can I and can't I skimp on things? I have a concept for a card game called cat curling. The idea is that you are curling, the Olympic sport, but instead of giant stones, you have cats. I conceive that as a card game where you all stand back from the table and you lob the cat cards face up onto the scoreboard to see how many points you got, and then each cat has special abilities, right? Mr. Fluffy Pants, if any cat comes in contact with them, they go under him because he is so fluffy. Bun Bun the Scratcher will destroy the first card to touch him, right? For that, I can write that game. I could print on demand that game and just list Mr. Fluffy Pants does this. That will not be a popular game because the people that will buy a game called Cat Curling want pictures of cats. So I need probably custom cartoony plump cat art. And I will need one for every card. It'll have to be different. So my cost for that has to be up here, which is why you have not yet seen a game called Cat Curling. That may still happen someday. But I can play test it without that element. I can write all the cards. I can see if it's fun just at the first stage. Do my friends enjoy it? Or do they go, we would rather gouge our eyes out than play test another session of cat curling, please. Can we play unexploded cows? That at least is. So that's one of the points where you're like, what are the costs? What can I skimp on? I can decide I will just write this. I'll put it down for 3 months. I'll come back and I'll read through it and I'll be my own editor. I could skimp that way. This product will be a disaster if I do stick figure cats, right? There might be games out there where I can do stick figures and that'll work.
Cards Against Humanity is the best example of the cheapest game possible. It's just black on white and white on black text, and just that they could sell it for the same cost because people just perceive it as this is a card game. Card games cost this much. They are printing money because of just how basic their layout and art costs are.
But they had a brilliant concept, and it doesn't require other things. Order of the Stick is a popular stick figure webcomic. It's stick figures. That's all it... I mean, there's other stuff, and he does a brilliant job with it, don't get me wrong. But it is just stick figures. On the other hand, that niche is probably filled now. So the next fantasy stick figure webcomic probably won't be as popular. Even though Cards Against Humanity is basically just apples to apples with more swear words and
fewer rules.
And fewer rules and more penile references... It's bigger now, so when anyone else comes up with a game where there's an example card and a subject card and you judge them, everyone says, well, that's just a ripoff of Cards Against Humanity. Even though there's an older game that established this. But that means if you want to... Now, some people... There was Crabs Adjust Humidity, which are just cards for Cards Against Humanity. But you're not getting into a new market that way, so... All right, we should wrap this up sometime soon. I do want to see if anyone else has a question, a burning question that they want us to try and answer in less than 10 minutes. We got a question.
Really quick question.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier on in one of your longer rants, free layout software.
Uh-huh.
You got a name?
So there was for quite a while GIMP, G-I-M-P, which is the graphic...
That's photo editing software, but what about like layouts for books?
Yeah, he wants more of like
right.
Page maker.
So if PDFs, go to the internet, go to the internet and type in free page maker, and a list of equivalents will come up. In fact, just recently, I use PageMaker, so I don't worry about what the free options are. They are out there. Frequently, the main difference frequently is compatibility and documentation. But the popular ones will frequently have message boards supporting them. Just recently in the industry, someone put out a meme that was like, if you want Word, use LibreOffice. It's the free equivalent. And they had a whole bunch of those, and it included several PageMaker equivalents. The other thing is, you can do layout in Word or LibreOffice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. But I know people who are smart and have successful products in this industry who do.
I mean, I could do it all in Photoshop, too, but that would be a real pain in the butt.
Exactly. Same thing.
So one thing to look out for when you're looking for freeware is that sometimes they'll have microtransactions like saving your file.
Yeah.
And so you want to make sure that before you do a ton of work, that that work can actually be saved, exported, and used.
Yeah, totally true.
Okay, in the absence of freeware, if I were to acquire a professional layout software, what's industry standard?
PageMaker?
Yeah, PageMaker. Really. Maybe InDesign?
Is that the Mac equivalent?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they have InCopy.
I remember them mentioning InDesign 3 years ago when I was here last time.
Yeah. InDesign is basically, it's what Paizo uses.
Yeah.
And a lot of these now, it may cost you more in the long run, but a lot of these now, you can have an updated cloud-based version for $10 a month.
Yeah.
Yes, that's $120 a year, but... You can get it for a month, do everything you're going to do, stop your subscription, put out your product, and if 3 months later you are ready for another layout project, pick it up again. Great. Any other questions? Thank you all. It's been a lovely panel. I appreciate it very much. Yeah. Have you noticed me shooting your fingers?
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction PaizoCon 2019 seminar coverage. We'd like to thank Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad and Justin Sluder of Justin Sluder for the recorders they provided, as well as the KD Con team for their diligent work. To find this and other great convention coverage, visit NoDirectionPodcast.com.